Hello, and welcome to another edition of Kaleidoscope. This is Magda Zenon, recording from Nicosia, and with me, all the way from New York, New York, I have Elpida Tsivikos, a Cypriot American artist, director, curator, and producer, who's based in New York, who will introduce herself to us. Welcome, Elpida.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to speak with you.
Elpida, I've always believed that the arts, I'm a peace builder, okay? My big title is I'm a peace builder and a peace activist. But I've always been a big believer that peace and healing is more effective when it comes through the arts, whether it's painting, singing, drawing, acting. And that's a lot of what you do, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a lot of what my work is. You know, from a very young age, I don't know, I believe that it has a lot to do with being Cypriot. I've known that the world is a difficult place to be in. A lot of people, you know, maybe have really different experiences, but I think when you're Cypriot, and you know the history of our little island, it brings a lot to your existence and sort of heaviness and an extreme beauty as well that you have to hold space for simultaneously. And for me, that always led me to the arts, even when I was very, very little. My mom said I used to dance around the house. And so when I was 3 years old, she put me in dance classes, even though I was supposed to be 4 to start. And I taught myself to play piano by ear, and I taught myself to sew, and I would make clothing. And it's been a way for me to cope always with everything that's happening around me. And I really believe that maybe not everyone's art form is activism, but for me, my activism comes through my work. And I believe that the way that I can change the world is through the art that I create, whether it's very directly revolutionary or very subtly revolutionary. I know that the impact I leave on the audience is going to be the largest thing I can do, and the way that I can make change, if I can bring them joy, if I can bring them peace, if I can bring them catharsis, if I can just give them a space of community in a very difficult time. And that's what I strive to do. I studied drama, but also I minored in art and public policy because I was always very politically involved and politically engaged. I grew up in the diaspora, and my father was very involved in every single Cypriot American organization and has always been an activist and a person who has fought for the liberation of Cyprus. And the way that that manifested for me was through my work. And I continue to do it, not just in directly making shows, but I also have a program for formerly incarcerated people who have served time in prison.
I think that's the one. When I read your CV, I think that's the thing that I picked up first. That stood out. There's a lot. You've got a really rich CV and a creative CV, but I think that's the project.
Yeah.
That actually stood out for me, because the incarcerated are even more forgotten than the women. Okay, people assume they just don't exist. They put away in boxes and that's over. So people don't take into consideration.
Yeah, well, the way that
their well-being and the fact that they need to come back into the community afterwards.
Yeah, so the way that program started was, one, just my relationship with the arts, like I've said, have always been a sort of way to cope with reality and have an outlet for my feelings and the things happening around me and creating really healthy, beautiful spaces.
Can I just interrupt you there as well? I think the other thing that separates you or is distinctive of you is you use public spaces. You don't necessarily use theaters.
Yeah.
You use parks, community centers,
yeah,
waterways.
Yeah.
So you use the space we live in.
Yeah, that's exactly. Well, I want art to be accessible. That's another thing. I mean, I guess I'll speak on that in a second, because it's one of my favorite things to talk about. And also has to do with being Cypriot and where I'm from. But, the program for formerly incarcerated people started because one of, my shows, Quince, It had a character who was in and out of prison, and we were auditioning actors, and they really just did not have, they were actors and they were acting. And so my collaborator and I, Camilo Quiros Vasquez, who's Mexican American, he reached out, we both reached out to this organization called Rehabilitation Through the Arts, which is an organization that goes into prisons and does theater. And they recommended a few people to us, and only one of us sent an interview. And we don't do auditions when we do plays, we just do dialogues. I just like to talk to people. So it was at a time in my life where I was thinking, what am I doing? You know, I'm making theater. It makes some people happy, but really this, you know, this industry is really messed up too. And what kind of impact am I really making on the world? And I know I'm very smart, and I know I'm very articulate, and then maybe I should be doing something else. And I received this video from one of my performers, and one of my close collaborators now, Jose, who had just gotten out of prison. He had been there for 20 years. And he was just saying how doing theater in prison completely rehabilitated him. And he went on and on. And I remember I was in Austin, Texas for work. I was looking out the window of the hotel room and I just started crying. And I thought, this is exactly why I do this. So we put him in the show, and he's phenomenal. He's been in every single one of my shows ever since. And when he came to his first rehearsal, he was on his way there, and there were a bunch of police sirens, and he arrived and he was having a panic attack. And I sat with him. I
The
didn't,
trigger moment,
yeah.
the siren, your trigger.
Yeah. And so I sat with him in a corner, and I gave him all the things that I use when I'm having bad anxiety. You know, I have these like really interesting smelling things in my bag, and a different scents and things to touch. And I was doing breathing exercises with him, and he was crying, and he was, you know, he had just gotten out of prison, and then he was okay. And we formed this very strong bond because of it. And we dreamed of creating a program for the rest of the people that have had that experience, and a lot of his friends from prison who he did theater with. And I applied for funding, and I got the funding. Camilo and I, my collaborator and the co-founder of One Whale's Tale, we got the funding. It's been a few years now that we've been doing this program, and so it's got about 5 to 10 people in it. And a lot of the different institutions who have programs like this have very structured programs, but the way that I do it is I just work with the guys on what they need in that moment. They need advice about,
And
credit
that's what I was
cards.
going to ask you. That's what I was going to ask you. Do you improvise or do you have a structured dialogue? And to me, you sounded like someone that did improvisation, not say, "Oh, you missed a line or you missed a word."
No. I start each session with really what they need. I do different modalities of art. Sometimes we do movement into writing exercises. They're all poets, really amazing poets. One of them's a flute player. Sometimes we do scene study, and I'll assign them scenes. Sometimes I just bring them to a Broadway show and take them out to dinner because they deserve it. And sometimes we just do lectures, you know, talking about, a few of them have children's books or books out, talking about different ways of moving through the world and how they're no longer in prison. And so they're trying to develop these artistic relationships, and they're noticing that it's very transactional, and how to shift from this sort of survival mindset into the art world, and how to get your book sold. And you know, one of them had a lot of trouble with credit cards and got a credit card right out of prison, totally messed up his credit. And he'd never, I mean, he went into prison when he was like 15, and then he got out when he was 36. So, you know,
And he didn't know how to manage it. Even us that have lived through life normally have a problem with credit cards. Never mind someone that has never had to deal with this on a
or
day-to-day basis.
budgeting, you know, how to deal with budgeting. All these different things. And one of them, he just became applicable for his passport, so we financially helped him with that to make sure he could get his passport and he'll be able to travel. And he wants to come to Cyprus as the first place he goes out of the country. So for me, that program, I mean, they're there for me. Those boys are there for me as much as I am there for them. And I love them, and they are so inspiring, and they are the biggest theater geeks you'll ever meet. I mean, I take them out and they just talk about Shakespeare and like Broadway shows all night long. And I sit there and go, this is so funny. But I think, you know, I always say that the way you change the world is how you live your life. And so for me, arts are healing. And so many of these boys have PTSD and all these different things. And, you know, I have my own problems and art helps me. So I use that with them. So it's
how do they find you?
Well, a lot of them have really been people that have been in prison with Jose, who's my collaborator, who worked on Quince, and they're all slowly getting out of prison. And so he'll invite different people in. We've reached out to different organizations, or sometimes we post things online. We don't want a million people to join. It has to be small. I'm not running an institution. I want it to be very, very personal, and I want everything we do to be very intentional. So it's a very small program, and it's really like word of mouth. Sometimes they'll have friends they want to invite in and stuff like that. And then I also put all of them in my plays whenever they want. At the last show I did, which was called Private Party, they were all in the play. All five of them from the program, except for one, he couldn't get out of work, but it was really fantastic. So yeah, that's one thing. And then I guess if you want me to talk about the site specific work I make, is I always think about, yeah.
I find that quite interesting. I mean, do you need to get permits? Do you have how do you draw an audience, or is it, natural that you have a scene in a space and people just join in?
All different.
I find it very interesting because to me, having it in public spaces is what theater should be all about.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be about closing people in the theater. No, going to a theater, which means I've got to buy a ticket and plan and book and whatever. Theater should just be happening, around me.
Yeah, I really struggle with commercial theater. I don't enjoy being inside theaters. I don't enjoy the decorum that people expect of a theater goer, not being able to speak, not being able to take out your phone. Often I'm very inspired when I see live performance and I want to write. And, you know, for so long, I'd want to take out my phone and write notes in my phone, and someone would scream, "Put your phone away." And I'd be like, "This is completely insane. Leave me alone. You don't even know what I could be doing on this phone. You know, you can't eat, you can't drink, you can't turn to your friend and say, 'I loved that.' You can't laugh too hard." You know, I don't like any of those things. The seats are uncomfortable. So a lot of my work is inspired by the way I grew up going to cultural events. And the same thing with my collaborator, Camilo, who's Mexican-American, also grew up in an immigrant household going to cultural events. So a lot of our work is centered around that and what those experiences are like, festivals and weddings and celebrations and what those feel like. There's such a theatricality to them. And they're also for the...
And a celebration. Most of them are such a celebration, regardless of what it is. It's a celebration. It's people having fun. It's people enjoying each other and coming together and bringing out their best selves, whether they're singing or dancing or creating a plate of moussaka.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, my family in Cyprus, we're from Inya, very small village. My family, they've been subsistence farmers until basically...
Where is Inya?
Inya's in the...
I don't know.
Inya's in the Agamas Peninsula.
Okay. I'm a newbie to Cyprus. I'm a South African-born Cypriot. And I came to Cyprus in 2000. So I know the island, but I don't know it that well. I don't know the little villages well enough. So you're in the Kai, you're a Paphitisa.
I'm a Paphitisa. I'm an Akamiotisa. And I'm an Inyatisa. So it's a tiny village in the Agamas Peninsula, and most people have been subsistence farmers. So I think about them and what makes them gather, you know, what would interest them? Would they really want to go to a 4-hour Shakespeare play where you're not allowed to speak or move or eat. No, it's like there should be a table of gleftiko. You walk in, you grab a piece. There's zivania. You're sitting and you're talking and you're dancing and you're laughing. And those are the environments I try to create. I think about my people, like what I'm made of, where I'm from, and what would be appealing to them. Now, doesn't mean necessarily everything I do would be appealing to them, but the style that I approach it with is with that in mind. I also don't make really experimental work for that same reason, because that's just not my role in art making. I find that art has to have a function. And so to go back to the public spaces, I sometimes need permits. Yes, I mean, it depends. I'm usually inspired by a space and then I go from there. So one of the spaces I love to work in Brooklyn is called the People's Garden, and they have a sister garden called the Good Life Garden. Both of those gardens are not owned by the city of New York. They're owned by the community. And so because they're owned by the community, they're technically private land. So we don't need permits to work in those gardens. What's even cooler about it is that you still might upset people with sound. And so how do you deal with that? You actually talk to your community. You put out signs that say there's going to be an event here. You put out the times, and you actually have to have a relationship with the people around you. You have to create dialogues. And part of my work as an artist, I identify as a dialogical artist because I believe that most of my work is around the dialogues that are created. So my program with the formerly incarcerated people, that's art for me, because the dialogues that are happening between us is art for me. And so I try to always have real dialogue happening surrounding all my work. So that's one of the gardens I like to work in. Right now I'm curating and creative producing an entire festival in a new outdoor amphitheater in Brooklyn. And that'll be all of the month of June. It's called Sugar Sugar. And one of my shows will be the final performance and the sort of main stage. It'll be a two night run and pretty large scale. I'm really excited about it. There, we don't need permits. Also technically a private space. I co-founded a music festival that we also do in public spaces. Sometimes we work in venues with the music festival. It's a multi-day event, but we always have some outdoor stuff. When I first did my first successful project, Quince, which was at the People's Garden, what was really beautiful and usually is the comments on the New York Times reviews of my work. If you read the comment section of the New York Times reviews, you'll see, I mean, that's what I'm most moved by. And usually the New York Times, I mean, they are a failing institution that is very disconnected from the people. And you can tell that in a lot of their writing. And so one of the comments was, "This show is for the people, by the people." And that's what I wanted. You know,
that's what you wanted to hear. That's exactly what you wanted to hear.
Yeah. And I didn't do it thinking that, but that's the whole time I was thinking that show was during COVID. So we had a very limited amount of people inside the garden. But what was great was it didn't matter if you were inside the garden, you could be outside the garden and watch the show too. And that was fantastic. And that's also how I feel about the project I'm working on right now, Sugar Sugar, in the amphitheater, because it's not a closed amphitheater. It's along the East River coastline in Brooklyn, which means you could be on a jog and pass by a concert and hear it. You could be going over the Williamsburg Bridge and watch a dance performance from above. You can be on the street right outside of the amphitheater. You could be sitting on the lawn right on the shoreline. And I just want the work to be accessible. I want everyone to be able to see these things, and I want them to feel invited into them. I don't want to create closed spaces, because I think a lot of people think the arts aren't for me, or theater isn't for me, or this isn't for me, or I don't relate to this. And so what I try to do is just make this work very, very open. And often when I do work with theaters, they'll say, "How did you get this audience here? This is such a diverse audience in every way." And I go, "I just make work for these people. Like, this is, I don't make work for theater people. I make work for just people, like people like me, or like the people I'm around." I mean, most of my friends in New York City come from immigrant households as well. They're not Cypriot though. They're Latino, or, you know, Chinese or whatever it might be, all different immigrant households, we all have this thing in common. And I think a lot of us come from backgrounds where our parents and our grandparents didn't have choices in what they were able to do. And that's informed how we make stuff. We're not quite so esoteric about the work we make because maybe in a couple generations we could get to that. But right now we still have so much of, you know, I'm full of the blood of farmers, you know, so it's hard for me to make really, really abstract work. Because it doesn't seem so functional. But yeah, that's the origin of my site-specific work. And even when I do work inside a theater, for example, I did a show with a theater a couple of years ago, and they had just bought a new space that they were going to renovate. And that season for them, it's an off-Broadway theater called the Bushwick Star. They were doing shows in all different theaters all over the city while they were renovating their space. And we said, what if we just do it in this raw warehouse as is, no theater? It was just,
oh, much better.
Yeah. And it was cool. We painted the floor, the walls and the ceilings bright pink. And we made the whole space become this world. And so it wasn't a theater, it was a warehouse. And we were really happy to use it that way. And now they've opened up that space. They've done their renovations. They spent millions of dollars making it into a theater. But I was really excited to have worked in that context. And also my last show was in a warehouse as well, a large capacity warehouse. So I'm intimidated by theater spaces. I find it to be so limiting, the fourth wall, the stage, the audience. I remember in one of my shows, which was Kinsey, the one I keep bringing up that I'm doing again in the end of June. It's the story of a young Mexican American girl before her quinceañera, which is a sweet 15, a rite of passage that a lot of Latinos do, but
actually, it's the Latino community that says they quinceañeras.
Quinceañera.
Am I right?
Yeah, quinceañeras. Yeah, and
yes, it's from.
She wants to bring a girl to her quinceañera instead of a boy. And so the story is kind of about that, but it takes place at a quinceañera. So the audience is sitting at tables, there's food, there's drinks, there's a live band. And one night we had this table of women come in at the very end of the run. And it was a very successful run. It was sold out. These women were like in their 50s and 60s, definitely not your standard theater goers. They kept standing up, picking up their phones, recording, hooting and hollering at the actors. And I tell everyone before the shows, I speak to the audience. I say, you can talk, you can laugh, you can take pictures, you can post stuff on Instagram. Just please don't take a work call while you're in the audience, but I want you to feel free, like you're at a party. Mm-hmm. And these women were kind of pushing it a little bit. And I could see the actors were starting to get distracted. And I was sitting there as the director thinking, what do I do? And I was like, should we ask them to be quiet? And then I thought, these women, they were Latinas. They were
having the time of their lives.
Yeah. And they were shouting at the actors as if they were watching a telenovela, a soap opera. And I thought, right before I kind of turned into a theater person and was going to say, you guys have to tone it down, I thought, actually, this is amazing. These women don't go to the theater. They watch soap operas and they scream at the screen. And right now they're screaming at the actors and hooting and hollering and having the time of their lives. And you know what? This is who I want here. And so they, and then after I just stopped thinking that for a minute, I talked to the actors backstage as they came on and off. I made sure they were okay. I let them know, we're not telling them to stop. These women are amazing. And they had the times of their, they had the time of their lives. So this is the sort of environment I strive to create.
Can I ask you a practical question?
Yeah.
In a theater, you can buy tickets. In an open space, how do you control tickets? Because, I mean, you need to make a living.
Yeah. Well, a lot of my work is funded by grants. I receive funding. So I apply for funding and I receive it. And that's generally how I fund the work. I find that if you're trying to fund the work with ticket sales, you've gone too far already. It's a risk. And, you know, I know that not everyone has that control over
luxury.
Yeah. And I'm very, very lucky to receive funding. I mean, it's only because I've been working for so long. And it takes many years to get to that place. But it's such a risk to get to the point of the performance and know that the only way you can pay everyone is via ticket sales. And it's a little scary and it's volatile. And I really prioritize paying everyone very fairly because I personally couldn't work throughout my 20s as an actor or a director, work in the arts really at all, because everyone wanted me to work for free and I had to pay my rent and pay for food, and I had no extra money, so I was working like six jobs at a time just to be living in New York. And I had to turn down so many projects because everyone wanted you to work for free.
Free.
Yeah. So a lot of my funding comes from grants. I apply for funding, I'm awarded it. And based on that, everyone gets paid. So the pay is built into the budget. It's not an if, it's a guarantee. Then beyond that, it depends on the funding I received. Some of the funding I get requires the events to be free. So those events are free. We still try to do RSVPs just to get an idea of how many people are showing up. Other shows, when we get funding, it doesn't have to be free. We do ticketing. I always do a range of prices for the ticketing. So we'll do like a pay what you can ticket or like a lower price ticket and a higher price ticket. I like to experiment with ticketing tiers. So we'll have like a $10 ticket, a $40 ticket, and a $75 ticket. And it's you pick which one you can afford. And it's really just like an honesty thing. You know, if the $75 ticket's available for you, you buy it. You don't get anything extra. You just can afford a $75 ticket. Yeah. So yeah. And then, you know, for example, this festival that I'm doing, that I'm curating and creative producing, it's free. We want it to be free. And we know people are going to come in and out. The biggest thing about that is just being able to control the flow of people coming in and out. But the whole concept of that festival is that it is free and for people to come in. So it really just depends on the funding. Like I said, I think it's a really flawed model to try and pay everyone just with ticket sales. It puts you in a really risky place. It's great if
It
you
also
can
puts
do
a
it.
lot. It also puts a lot of pressure on the production team
Yeah.
because you're forced to produce something that you think is going to sell. And at the end of the day, you as actor, do you know if you're going to get paid if it doesn't work that well? And that should not be the purpose. I'm doing a job, so I should get paid for it in some way. I should get paid what my value is.
Yeah. And look,
Not everyone has that luxury, though, in this world that we live, of doing what you do.
yeah. And look, I mean, I pay people as well as I can, and I pay myself terribly. You know, I'm the strongest advocate to have on your team. And, you know, oftentimes it's at my own expense. I still always try to pay myself as well because I need to, but I have different streams of income. I work as a producer as well. I do, you know, a few different things. You know, it's hard to get rich in the arts. That can't be
No, it is hard.
what you set out to do. And I always say to people, you know, when we're taking them on or we're hiring them, I can pay you. You're not going to get rich off of this job, but we're going to make sure you're paid as well as you can be. And one of my values lies in fair pay. Because that's also, you know, especially in the United States and everywhere, I got kind of tired of seeing art made by people with trust funds exclusively. It was
Because
unrelatable.
they could afford it,
Yeah.
just because they could afford it,
Yeah. And
doesn't mean they want the talent.
I think it perpetuates the irrelevance of art because as somebody viewing that art or experiencing that art, it's often not so relatable. And most people don't have trust funds. And so, if only very, very wealthy people are making art and are participating in art, then it becomes more and more irrelevant to modern society. So, the way that I handle that is I pay people. And then, constantly, like I've said, theaters and institutions say, "Whoa, how did you get such an amazing, diverse cast?" And I said, "Yeah, I said, we pay them." We pay them.
Very simple.
Yeah.
Very simple. I mean, this podcast that I do, I've been doing it for about 11 years. I think I've got paid for it about 50 episodes. Because, firstly, I consider it my therapy. Okay, because I have a conversation with awesome women, and it helps me. But I also think at the time that I was starting these podcasts in 2013, women were not being called to speak. So I felt I had the means and I had the curiosity. And to me, it just needed to be done. And I just needed to have the people that I wanted there. So it was very easy. It's my art. My art is storytelling, not storytelling, getting you to tell your story. I'm the curious one that asks you the questions that others might not ask you or might feel too worried that they're putting you in a difficult position. But to me, storytelling, we do different kinds of storytelling. Yours obviously is bigger, but to me, giving people a space to be themselves, to tell their story, to bring out the best in themselves is a really, it's a joy to watch, actually, or to listen to in my case. But let's go on to your book. You've written a book.
Oh, yeah, I have.
Because let's get to the Cypriotness of Elpida. I know you're from Yoruba, but your cultural heritage is a very big part of other things that you do as well.
Yeah, I don't think you could get through a moment speaking to me without me talking about Cyprus. It's a part of everything I do. So, and even on days where I'm not talking about it, people ask
me. How often have you come back to Cyprus?
Oh, there's not. I first came to Cyprus when I was 6 months old, and then I was there at least once a year, sometimes twice a year, until I was 18. We would go for the entire summer, so like 3 months always. And then sometimes I would go with my father for Christmas or New Year's. Then once I was in college, my schedule when I was in university was more limited. I'd go in the summer. I was broke. Out of college, I was also broke. But I still went to Cyprus. It's something that was like instilled in me that it was no matter what, I had to go. And then towards the end of my 20s, I'm in my mid-30s now, I started to really spend a lot more time there. The past 5 years, I'd say I'm maybe in Cyprus 60% of the year and 40% of the time in New York. The past year, it's been a lot.
Call me when you're the next time you come to Cyprus.
I will. Yeah, I'm there a lot. What I've been doing is, it's also kind of COVID helped with this, that so many things, the norm became doing things remotely, things that we always did in person. Now I can do remotely. So whenever I'm in pre-production for a project or I'm in post-production for a project, I just leave and I'm in Cyprus and I'm close to my yaya, who I help take care of. She's my best friend in the world. I love her to pieces. Her name is Bertha.
Does she live in the village?
Yeah, she lives in the village. So I'm in the village every day with her, my Yaya Bersu. Bersifoni is her name. So right now I split my time between New York and Paphos, with a little time in Athens in between. So that's my life, and I'm really happy with it. And I'm a lot healthier the more time I get to spend in Cyprus and be close to my family. And I always say when I'm there, I match the world around me here. I match the landscape, all of the colors of my skin and my eyes and my hair, and everything about me matches my surroundings. And it's a very profound experience. And my book, A Life into Lands, there's an incredible art space in Lefkosia called Faneromenis, run by Kiriaki Costa, who's like a mentor to me. I stumbled in there years ago and fell in love with the store because it's so Cypriot. She does the most beautiful, she's an artist herself, and her art has a lot to do with Cyprus. And she integrates different things like Lefkaritika or just like the shape of Cyprus or mythology into her work.
Is that little store close to Faneromeni Church?
Yeah, it's directly outside of there. Oh. Yeah. And so,
And next to the Kalakathumena.
yeah, exactly.
Okay,
Yeah,
now
so
what exactly are
I
you
was going
talking
in
about?
there all the time and developed like a friendship with her. And at the same time, I've always done this. I've spent a lot of time in the village with my grandparents. I'd go to the fields with them. My Bapu died in 2019, but he was going to the fields up until the day before he died. So, and that's when my grandmother stopped going to the fields after my Bapu died. So my whole life I grew up with them as farmers. So I'd go to the Ambelia, we'd pick grapes together. Then I'd be there and I'd be making the wine with them and the Zivania and the Shujuka. And we'd pick the Sitari, then we put it in this machine that separates like the husk from the straw. I don't claim to be a good farmer, but I participate. We'd go to the goats together. I'd make halloumi with Yaya and Anari and all of these different things. I'd make bread with her from the wheat that we had picked and processed together. And I would put it on my Instagram, on my Insta stories. And Kiriaki always watched them. And I'd put little passages like, today we're going to the goats. And they'd be these little visual stories of life in my village. And she really fell in love with it. So she commissioned me to make a book out of these stories. And for me, it was just a way to kind of document all of these traditions, and ways of life that I knew were going to
That's
die.
awesome that you actually got to do it yourself next to your yaya. I mean, my family's from the city, so I didn't really get to. Although I did have, when I moved here, I moved in with my aunt who had this big corafi next to the house, and she would until the day she died, and she died at the age of 90, over 90, out in the corafi doing her olives and her vegetables and picking the oranges and making sure about the cats that were in the area. And I always tell my son, learn what she's doing, because if you can feed your family from the land outside your window, you are the richest person in the world. He never listened to me.
Well, it's true because my house and
I'm
pop.
looking, sorry to interrupt. I'm looking, I mean, she had lovely olives, which used to bring a lot of olive oil. I'm looking now that she's passed away. Olive oil is a bloody fortune. Buying it is a fortune. And I think of the 20, I came in 2000 and she died in 2016. For 16 years, I did not buy olive oil. And then suddenly, boom, no. And for 2 years afterwards, because I actually harvested them the year she passed away, and the oil lasted me for 2 years. But since then, boom, the price is a fortune. And I think to myself, I had this and it was nicer. We don't even talk about the quality. And I think people just wonder, I wish I'd been more of the land than I was.
I think I'm so lucky to have been brought into this world with family and the culture that I have. My grandparents and my father and his siblings had li literally nothing growing up. Absolutely nothing. They were starving most of the time. Everything they ate, they grew. They were very, very poor. And I feel like I'm so lucky to come from that because I am extremely grounded. And simultaneously, I got the opportunity to go to one of the best universities in the world and be an artist while also being humbled by the existence of subsistence farming, not even commercial farming, but farming just to survive. And not only just the stories of it, but I grew up going to the fields with my grandparents when I was really little. I didn't really understand what we were doing, but I still did it. My mom, I don't know how she got three kids, two boys and a girl across the world every single year, no matter what, before the internet. It instilled in us such an importance of what it means to actually be from somewhere else. But what I was going to say is we have this little field, a little garden next to my house, in Paphos, and it's a little bervoli that my grandparents planted with trees. And those trees, my Bapu's been dead now for 6 years, and those trees, they still have fruit. And I say every single day, and I when my father and I are in Cyprus together, which is very often, I'll pick the fruit and I say, look, Papua and Yaya are still feeding us. They're still feeding us. We have grapes, we have figs, we have olives, we have
Hello, me.
halloumi, we don't have growing, but I will say this past
Oh, from the
year, my Yaya, who's been declining just because she's getting older, it's been the first year I haven't been able to like take her out. We used to go to dinner. I mean, even a year ago, I'd take her to dinner. I take her to the mall. I just take her on little excursions. I take her to my house, and I can't really do that anymore. And it's been really difficult for me emotionally trying to, know that the torch is being passed. And
It's actually
so,
horrible. It's very draining, not draining, a deep sadness when you see the poor people around you aging.
yeah, I think about, I mean, I have a beautiful story, but I'll tell you this first. I always think with my Yaya, I think of the mythology of Medusa and how if you look back, you turn to stone. And I'm fine with Yaya, like I'm fine with how she is now. She doesn't talk that much. We can't do stuff together. We don't make shujuko. She doesn't cook for me anymore. Now I cook for her. And every once in a while, I'll start looking on my phone at all of these videos I have of her. And when I see the way she used to be, I get really, really sad. And I think, you know what? It's not the time to look back. Like, I'm paralyzed. I've turned to stone. All I can think about is who she was. And all of a sudden, who she is now isn't enough for me. And I want to live in the present with her right now. And wherever she's at has to be enough for me. So this has been this theme for me the past year or two of don't look back, you'll turn to stone. You have to just be present with her. But part of that came up this past fall. I was in Cyprus and it was olive season and I was looking at the olive trees and I was like, I want to pick the olives. And then I thought about how do I pick the olives? I'm like, well, come on, I'll be the you've done this with them.
How difficult can it
I'm
be?
like, you've done this with them, my grandparents. I talked to about them as a unit still, even though my Bapu's dead. You've done this with them for so long. Your whole life, you did these things with them. Come on. And I'm like, but I don't think I can do it without them. And I was up in the village. I said to my uncle, who still keeps up a lot of our fields and is the Mukhtari of our village. And
Village.
yeah, he's the antiprodro of the municipality of Agamas now too. And he's really an incredible, incredible man. I said, Fioyango, I want to pick olives. And he said, okay, I'll leave the tarps out for you tomorrow. So he makes his son grab the tarps for me. He leaves the tarps and the rake, and I just pick them up the next day. And I go down to my house, just to the olive trees we have there. And I look at them and I go, how the hell am I going to do this? I call my father. I'm like, Baba, like, what do I do? He's like,
What
he's like, Elpida, it is not rocket science. And I said, okay, are you sure? And he's like, yeah. So I wake up, I put the tarps down by myself, I put on my Bapu's shirt, like his cargo army navy shirt. I put on my jeans, I put a mandili over my hair. I put down the tarps and I just started picking the olives and I became addicted to it. It was the most beautiful experience. And all I cared about was olives for 1 week. It was me and the olives. It did not matter what was going on in the world. It was just olives. And I picked all the olives. I was very proud of myself. It was only a couple of trees at my house. It wasn't in our fields, even in the village. It was just our local trees. I think I picked about 50 kilos of olives, which is a lot. Everyone at the Ergostasio was the oilery was very impressed with me, and they said, "You did it by yourself?" And I said, "Yeah." And I made about 8 liters of olive
Oh,
oil.
wow.
Yeah, and
Did
my.
you take it back to America with
I
you,
took
the
some,
olive
yeah, and I
oil?
have some in my house in Cyprus, and very, very special people get gifts of it because there's not a lot. And it was so cool because I thought, okay, Yaya can't come down here with me. She can't watch me do this. I can't even really get her out of the house anymore. So I have to do this by myself. And I'd pick the olives all day. And then I'd go up to the village. I say, Yaya, I picked the olives. And I'd show her the pictures. And she'd say, Bravo. And then when I was done, I told her how much olive oil I made. And she said, Hice machete. And she said, You did it. You're very good. And I was really impressed with myself. And I will
You
do
should
it.
be.
I'll do it every year. I will do it every year. I mean, it's now, that's part of my book too, is like all of the book, I was doing these things with them. And now it's this time where I have to do it without them. And it's intimidating. But then I remember that they're farmers.
It's not rocket science. You must remember,
Yeah,
it's
is
not
that
rocket
right? They didn't even go to first
science.
or second grade. And so I can do it. It doesn't mean I'll do it well. The first time or the second
Yeah,
time.
but what does well mean? You will do it the best you can.
Yeah,
But I've
exactly.
also got a little story. I cut the last olives from my aunt, and I think it was something like 20 liters. Okay, so it was quite a lot. But that Christmas, instead of taking wine every time I went to someone's house, I got little 250 milliliter bottles. My son designed a label with my aunt's picture of it and her name's Christina's Oil. And that's what we gifted people. Not a lot because it's, I mean, you don't want, but it was, and I've still got a bottle. But it was such a nice feeling that you met, it's your own wine and her picture
Yeah.
was on it. And my son took such pride in designing a photo, a label with her picture on it. It was
Yeah.
very creative, but really nice. And it has a lot more value when you give it as a gift.
Yeah.
It is valued more.
Yeah, I'm tell everyone I made this with my hands and it's like what
Or
better gift?
micrography.
Yeah, what a better gift. But another example of how my grandparents, they are still providing even when my Bapu's not even alive, and Yaya can't really do much anymore. And yet, I now have olive oil for the year, and I'll do more next year. I can't wait. I can't wait till October. As someone was asking me about a project, and I agreed to it, and it was going to be in October. And all I could think was, "Oh my God, I'm not going to be able to pick the
Yeah, now they're gonna
olives."
do them both.
Yeah, and then the project got canceled, and I was like, you know what? It's no problem. I really have to pick these olives.
You better invite me to your village in October. It's a perfect opportunity. I come to Bafos quite regularly because I have friends there that come regularly. So we'll make a plan.
Yeah, I would love to.
But it's coming to the end of this conversation, although we could talk for hours because I love these stories of Cyprus. I mean, they remind me a lot of, they remind all of us that are from the diaspora of what a big part of our identity, our Cypriotness is, and the family here. Is there anything you want to say before we close? I know you were recently at the Cyprus Diaspora Forum. I was on in the forum last year.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I was invited to be a part of it, and it was
How did
really.
they connect with you? Where did they find you? Where Paul is rather he's a very creative human being. He knows these things.
Yeah, I've known Paul for a couple of years, and my friend Laura's involved with the Diaspora Forum as well.
Yes.
And
And Paul's a Bafiti. Isn't he a Bafiti, Paul?
yeah, he is. Yeah, he is.
Okay.
Yeah. And I also recently started my own foundation called the Cyprus Foundation, which is all about cross diaspora dialogues through art. So trying to connect the entire diaspora through different artistic projects and stuff like that, connecting everyone with Cyprus. And it's a foundation that's only about arts and Cyprus and the spreading of knowledge of Cyprus. And so I got to talk about that a lot at the Diaspora Forum, which was really great. And I'm very excited about the future of the Cyprus Foundation, and what I'll be able to do. But it really just advocates and promotes and is committed to preserving and advancing the history and the culture and identity of Cypriots through events, exhibitions, performances, mentorship and dialogues that kind of create a bridge between Cyprus, the USA, and the greater diaspora. So just because of my beliefs that are, through constant presence in the cultural sphere, I think we're investing in the future of a free Cyprus and solidifying our place and significance in the global stage.
And I agree with you. To me, this bridging of cultures, bridging of dialogues is very important. It's building trust. It's building strength. It's building community. And it's also rebuilding, because I think sometimes we lose our faith in ourselves and in who we are as a people. And I've always had been dubious about whether we as Cypriots actually know our identity and whether we connected to being Greek or being Turkish. It's always a challenge to me, this, that sometimes you'll speak to Cypriots and they'll just identify as Greek Cypriots. They won't identify as a Cypriot.
I identify as a Cypriot.
To me, it's very important that you've got to say that I'm a Cypriot. I'm not a Greek Cypriot.
Well,
Turkey,
I'll tell you something. I've been spending a lot of time in Greece, and they don't let you forget for one second that you're Cypriot. I mean, it's like my friends from Europe and the US who experience it are so surprised that it's one of the first things. I mean, sometimes it's very strange. They'll comment on the way I look and say that I look Cypriot. Obviously, the way I talk. I remember one day I ordered a cappuccino. And I ένα cappuccino σε παρακαλώ με γάλα αμυγδάλου. And I later and the guy said Κύπρια είσαι, and I was like, okay, what did I say? I didn't say je, I didn't say sh, I didn't say lalo.
What did I say?
What did I say? And I saw my father later that day, and I was like, Baba, I said this. What did I say? And he said, you said cappuccino. They can't say ch. They say cappuccino, so they knew you were Cypriot. And it's like, it's really funny. And so it's like, you know, we have a Hellenic history in Cyprus, but Greece is a country and we're not a part of the country of Greece. And it's really hard to describe that in Greek because we don't have a different word for Hellene and Greek. It's the same word in Greek. We say Elinas. But in English, what I always try to clarify is I say to people, I don't have Greek citizenship. I'm not a citizen of Greece. I have Cypriot citizenship. It's not the same citizenship. I'm Cypriot. I could live in Greece just as easily as I could live in any country in Europe with my EU passport. And so we have to differentiate the nation versus the history. And we do have Hellenic history in Cyprus, as well as a bunch of other histories. But, you know, we are of Hellenic descent in some capacity, but we aren't from Greece, the country.
And not exclusively Hellenic descent.
No.
I mean, I was married to a Greek. So I lived in Greece for about 18 years between Thessaloniki and Rhodes. When I was in Rhodes, my Cypriot accent didn't differ. When I was in Thessaloniki, my say Kypria. Because the Rhodian accent is very Cypriot. If you spend time in the Dodecanisa, there used to be a boat that used to leave Biria, it stopped at a few islands, then stop in Rhodes and then in Limassol. You only knew who the Cypriots were when the Rhodites got off, because the accent's very similar. So I agree with you. I think we need to acknowledge that there is a Hellenism in us and not in all of us, but we are a nation in ourselves. We are Cypriot. And I think it's something I'm challenged with in Cyprus, that people, for some reason, need to identify with Greece or Turkey.
Well, this
they
is,
don't identify with Cyprus.
Well, this is part of I could talk for hours, but very simply.
No, this is another discussion.
Yeah, the British coined us Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots as an attempt to, one, divide us, and two, make it seem like neither group is from the island of Cyprus, that the Greek Cypriots came from Greece and the Turkish Cypriots came from Turkey. Yeah. But Turkey didn't even exist until the 20s. So if you talk to a Turkish Cypriot whose family has been here since the 1500s, they're not going to identify as being from Turkey. Most Turkish Cypriots never went to Turkey, had never been to Turkey, had no relationship with mainland Turkey. And the same goes with Greek Cypriots. Didn't come from Greece. It's a misnomer, and it's a way to deny the indigenous separate people and deny the existence of the indigenous population of Cyprus, as if the island was not inhabited by anyone. And that's not true. And we know that's not true. So
I think we could make this into another podcast, but I agree with you. This we have been inadvertently been been denied the right to an identity that belongs here on this island.
Yeah.
Okay, I think this is a good place to stop because we would be opening another conversation that we don't have the time
yeah.
for. I'm really glad we finally connected. I look forward to when you come back to Cyprus. I will send you my number, WhatsApp number on Messenger so that you can connect with me. And always interested to know how arts can be used to transmit culture as well as do trauma healing.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad you asked me to come on here. This was a lovely conversation. I really appreciated it. And it was great chatting with you.
And keep me in touch with anything that's happening in my area or direct me to women. I only do interviews with women. Any women you feel I might be, would be interesting for me to speak with.
Okay, I will.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
And have a lovely rest of the day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open. Diverse. Free.